I'm Lister Sinclair, and this is Ideas.
Our sense of vision is incredibly limiting, and sometimes distorting. And the unfortunate thing is we have this tremendous confidence in what vision tells us is pretty much the whole story, or enough of the whole story to get us through life. In a hunter-gatherer world, it was. But now we've got 5 billion plus people on Earth, and a lot of us are equipped with powerful technologies, and we're causing impacts which are very, very negative. And what we don't see with our eyes is all the interconnectedness of our lives.
That's the voice of Copthorne MacDonald, engineer, writer, inventor. 30 years ago, Cop, as he's known, was a corporate engineer in the United States. He designed several elegant devices, among them slow-scan TV, and for Westinghouse, a system that put pictures and sound on standard phonograph records. At that point in his life, Cop believed that technology held the answers to almost all the mysteries of life. Then other doors opened to psychology, the alternative movements of the 70s, meditation, mind-brain study, and feminism. Today, Cop MacDonald lives in Charlottetown. He is an independent writer and scholar exploring the nature of wisdom and whether or not it's possible to create what he calls a wisdom-based society. Tonight on Ideas, a profile of Copthorne MacDonald by author and broadcaster Deirdre Kessler.
I first worked with Copthorne MacDonald when we were hired to co-write an energy technologies workbook for grade 10 students. Cop lives and works in a spacious third-floor apartment in a historic house on the Charlottetown waterfront. Huge elm, linden, and maple trees line the street. Perfectly tended lawns slope to the water. We sat on his third-floor deck and looked out over the Charlottetown harbor. It was high summer. We brainstormed and joked about making our student workbook teacher-proof. What we did was so akin to play that it seemed we were being very nicely paid to bathe our brains in laughter. Copthorne MacDonald frames his life and work playfully. In his words, the universe is a great, wondrous experiment, and we humans are just a little node of universal process over in a corner running our own sub-experiments.
One of the pieces of intellectual learning that I think we could all use a deeper understanding of is evolution and how evolution works. And what has been going on in the universe for the past 15 billion years? And one way of looking at it is that energy has gone through a hierarchical progression of system, what could be called system building. Started with the first informational structure was that of elementary particles. At the Big Bang itself, there was just energy. At the first instant of our universe, there was just energy. And we've gone through this stage of system building, where elementary particles became the components of in the next level of system, which were atoms. Atoms became components in the next level, which are molecules. Then we started getting some very fancy, very special molecules, including some which could self-replicate. And then we moved into living systems. And these living systems got more and more complex and developed mental capabilities. In the first case, just to help them survive and reproduce. But in the case of human beings, the mental systems that developed were a general purpose, which have allowed us to become agents of evolution.
In 1941, 5-year-old Cop, his 3-year-old brother David, and his mother and father lived in Winnetka, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. The house was rented. It was a two-story frame house in what was then an ordinary middle-class neighborhood. The father commuted to work in Chicago. The mother was a housewife. Dick and Jane was Kopp's first reader. One of Kopp's earliest memories, from when he was about 5 years old, is of being awakened by his mother's singing.
Good morning, little yellow bird, yellow bird, yellow bird. Good morning, little yellow bird. How are you? I had my own bedroom, and the sun was coming through the window, and I was awakened by the sound of my mother standing at the foot of my bed, singing this song that she often sang to wake me up. Now, I've tried singing this to other people later in life, and it didn't work the way it worked for me. I mean, I woke up, and there was my mommy down at the end of the bed, and the sun was coming through the window, and I was just all smiles, because, hey, this was the start of a brand new wonderful day. Oh, how neat. And I don't know whether it's brainwashing in the way it should be, but anyway, I got in the habit of being excited about getting up in the morning and starting another day, and this is carried on through my whole life. I mean, I don't always wake up with this rise and greet the rosy-fingered dawn kind of attitude, but I do most of the time.
If his mother helped him set the tone of his life, his father helped by having the right tool for learning at the right time. Kopp and his father had in common a love of radio. His father gave him a crystal set on his 5th birthday.
Well, I can remember being in my bedroom with this table next to my bed, and my father handing me this thing, which was called a crystal set, and it was, oh, maybe 6 inches by 6 inches square, and it had this coil of wire on the back and this funny little thing called a crystal and a cat's whisker on it, and I could sense by his excitement that this was really something neat, although at first it didn't look like something neat. And so he set it on the table, and then he told me that we needed an antenna, I think he called it an aerial, and a ground. So, okay, I didn't know what this meant, but we went up to the attic and discovered that somebody had already put an aerial up there, and we just needed to bring a wire down from that. So he threw it out of the attic window, and we pulled it in under the bedroom window and hooked it up to one of the spring clips on this thing. And then he ran another wire over to the radiator in the corner of the bedroom. And he took these earphones, as they were called in those days, and there were a couple little metal clips on the end of those, and he attached them to another couple of pieces of metal on this thing. And then he put the earphones on his own head and started twiddling with this little thing called the cat's whisker that had a little wire that came down and touched the crystal. And he spent a couple of minutes doing this, and then his face brightened, and he had this big smile, and he took out the earphones, and he adjusted them so they'd fit my head, and then them on my head and over my ears, and I heard music, and it was this moment of great astonishment and wonder. Here was this little thing sitting on my table, and my head was filled with music.
For Christmas that same year, his father gave him a two-tube radio kit. Christmas afternoon, Kopp watched as his father put it together. His father was a corporate salesman who was transferred frequently. The family moved to Arlington, Virginia in 1943. The next year they moved to Webster Groves, Missouri, The year after that, they were transferred to Bronxville, New York. Kopp recalls a particular day in the Bronxville library. He was 9 years old. He was reading the modern radio book for boys. He found a whole chapter on the radio that his father had given him for Christmas of 1941. He read that he could turn the radio his father had built into a shortwave receiver by attaching plug-in coils. Kopp rushed home, told his father about what he'd discovered, and the two of them set off to Radio Row, Cortlandt Street, in New York City, to buy the shortwave equipment. Back home, they plugged in one of the new coils. They could listen to the BBC. They could listen to Radio Moscow. The family moved back to Winnetka in 1947. 4 years later, his father was transferred to Crystal Lake, Illinois. And the next year, they moved again to Missouri. All this time, Kopp was bitten hard by the radio bug. He got his ham license at age 15.
This childhood interest sort of built over the years, and it reached a fruition or a climax of sorts in my teens when I passed the federal license and passed the federal exam and became a ham radio operator. Now, in addition to listening to radio, I was able to communicate with people long distances away via Morse code and voice. And I found this just terribly exciting, and I was interested in the technical aspects of it, and I messed around with antennas to get the best signal out. And when I was in university and had my first used car, it wasn't very long before there was a two-way radio in the car.
Spider Moon grows.
When he was 17 and ready for university, he entered the engineering school at the University of Kentucky. His father had been transferred to Lexington, and the family had moved once again. Tuition at the University of Kentucky in 1953 was $60 a semester. Kopp married young and worked his way through university. He spent nights and weekends at the transmitter of a local 5-kilowatt AM station. As he puts it, he hammed his way to and from work in his oil-guzzling 1948 Chrysler. In fact, most of the legroom under the dash of that Chrysler was taken up with a Second World War surplus AM transmitter. And his life was full. He had his studies, his job at the radio station, his marriage. He and his wife lived in a variety of dirt-cheap accommodations, including a garret apartment that had so many mice, he caught two at once in a trap.
It tells me that many of you listeners still prefer the 78s to the 45s. Seems like you think you get more for your money. Well, if you plan on getting a new record player, be sure it plays 45s, baby. They are the coming thing. They've got...
In 1957, 20-year-old Copthorne McDonald developed an accessible form of communications. It was a process for sending pictures over ordinary ham radio equipment. To this point in his engineering education, he had had no design experience, yet he developed a whole new communications system.
It happened in the engineering library at the University of Kentucky, where I was going through engineering school. So this one particular day, I'd been working at some task for a long time and getting bored and tired, and I decided that, all right, I was going to give myself a little break and read something interesting. Interesting at this time meant something technical, so I pulled off of one of the shelves a recent copy of the Bell System Journal and started thumbing through it, and there was an article in there about a system that, an experimental system that had been built at Bell Labs to send signatures over a telephone line from the main office of a bank to a branch bank. And as I read this article, it suddenly occurred to me that television did not have to be sent at 30 pictures every second and take a big wide bandwidth. that it just might be possible to send a picture over a ham radio voice channel using regular ham radio equipment. Now, this was 1957. The first satellites had not yet gone up. People were not sending pictures around the world, and the idea of hams in their own houses being able to send pictures anywhere on Earth was a pretty exciting idea. On paper, it looked like it would work. And so I approached the head of the department and said, look, could I make a course out of this, an independent problem course? And he agreed. And so I set myself up in the corner of the laboratory and with a table there and a sign saying, please don't disturb, and started building this system that I very much hope would work. But at the same time, here I was, a 20-year-old student who had not worked out in the world. I had no experience prior to this in designing a system this sophisticated. And I kept waiting for the hammer to drop, for some fatal flaw to appear. So I worked section by section on this system, and came the time for the big test. All the bits and pieces had been checked out, and this system did not involve a camera. The way that it picked up the image was with a device called a flying spot scanner, and I had to make a slide that used a photographic negative. And I remember I'd taken a shot of a beer ad on a billboard that had a pretty girl's face and some fairly large letters on it, and I thought that would be a good test object. And so I shoved the slide in the flying spot scanner and made a few adjustments, and there on the screen was the picture. I'd succeeded.
Kopp graduated from university and got a job as a junior engineer with ITT Labs in Nutley, New Jersey. After 2 years, he left this job for another with Westinghouse in Elmira, New York. His daughter Beth was born in 1960. Westinghouse transferred him to their laboratories in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1964. In these years following his graduation from engineering school, Kopp proved his technological genius. He designed a slow-scan TV system that was used by the U.S. Weather Bureau to transmit weather radar pictures over telephone lines. He headed a design team that developed TV-related test equipment for use in broadcast and cable TV facilities. Then one day, something changed. In 1965, in a hotel in Pittsburgh, Kopp was introduced to the ideas of Abraham Maslow. Years ago, plunks us in the middle of the 60s, the Beatles, the war in Vietnam, flower power, and a management training seminar.
I had been sent by this large corporation I worked for to a management training seminar. For the first time, I had people reporting to me, and so I learned how to deal with them, what motivates them, and so forth. Part of the session, the morning session, dealt with Abraham Maslow and his theories of motivation. There was a break in the course of the events, and there was an older man who had been involved in organizing this the seminar, and he strolled over to me and he said, how are you enjoying it? And I said, well, this fellow Maslow's ideas are really interesting. I'm, particularly intrigued by this concept of self-actualization. And a big smile across this fellow's face. And he said very intently, he said, "Yes, the idea of becoming all we're capable of becoming." And that introduction to Maslow, and particularly that fellow's phrase, have just stuck with me over the years, and it's been a real guiding force in my life.
The year after Kopp was so struck with Maslow's concept of self-actualization, he saw something else which altered his approach to his life and his engineering work.
Well, my mother was a great, great lover of art, and she and my father at this time lived in suburban Chicago, and I was there on an American Thanksgiving visit, and she and I, as we often did, went down to the Art Institute, which is this wonderful art museum in Chicago. And we were strolling around and looking at the Impressionists, which we both loved, and we wandered into this room where there was a neon sculpture. It was fairly plain. I have no idea who the artist was. But at that moment, I said to myself, wow, you know, neon tubing is a medium for art. Electronics could be a medium for art. And I had absolutely no doubt that I could come up with something more interesting artistically in the electronics medium than what I was looking at right there, and or what I had seen in the way of technological art up to that time.
Kopp flew home and went right to work. He now headed the design team at Ball Brothers Research Corporation in Boulder, Colorado. He researched the field of technological art and found literally nothing about it at the art library of the university. He had an idea to display stereo music on the screen of an oscilloscope, to have the left stereo channel move the spot of light left and right, and the right stereo channel move it up and down. He collaborated with a graduate student to make a plaster sculpture of a life-sized, seated, nude woman. Her face was a cathode ray tube upon which appeared constantly changing linear patterns of light. They called their work, "Speak That I May See." Kopp found that the music of Jimi Hendrix looked especially good dancing on the sculpture's face. "Speak That I May See" was presented first at a Boulder art show and then at an exhibition at the Brooklyn Museum, sponsored by a newly formed group called EAT, Experiments in Art and Technology. Kopp realized he could possibly make a career in electronic art, but he was made an engineering offer he couldn't refuse. He was handed a whole new division of Vidcom Electronics in New York City. He would be research director with a fat salary. He would have a free office, laboratory, and living quarters with maid service. I'm not kidding, the maid's name was Lolita, at the Great Northern Hotel. The Great Northern Hotel was in the same block as Carnegie Hall on 57th Street. For the next 2 years, this 60-hour-a-week engineering job captured his sense of fun and adventure. By 1969, Kopp was a divorced single parent. He remarried New Year's Eve that same year. This music is a recording he made of his wedding in Studio A of Fine Recording. Studio A was the ballroom of the Great Northern Hotel.
We come here this evening with Kopp and Madeline for the solemnization of their marriage.
The new family moved to a small apartment on the Upper West Side of New York. Vidcom Electronics went bankrupt the next year, and Kopp, his new wife Madeline, and 10-year-old Beth embarked on a journey around the world. The trip lasted 13 months.
traveling third world countries helped sensitize me to world problems that had never become real to me before. The world does not face a whole bunch of separate problems. That these problems cannot be looked at in isolation from each other. That things like resource depletion, the growing of food, population, are all linked to each other. And what we're really talking about is a multifaceted problematique, a very complex, overarching problem of which these are just aspects. And realizing this, it changed my thinking, and I realized that we oversimplify all the time, and we've got to get away from that.
I believe in God and Senator Dodd and keeping old Castro down.
The students retreated behind a hill. The guardsmen followed. That's when the shooting started.
Keep moving!
The political and social climate of the United States that Cop Madeline and 11-year-old Beth returned to was dominated by the Vietnam War and Richard, I am not a crook, Nixon.
Speakers at the Washington Peace Rally included writers, artists, teachers, doctors, a whole cross-section of American society. Mrs. Martin Luther King made her plea for an end to the war in Vietnam.
We don't give a damn, the next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the early gates.
Well, the trip changed us. We, actually followed a little path around the globe and came back with sort of a different way of looking at things than when we left. Madeline had decided she wanted to go into nursing, and I was very eager to get involved with something of redeeming social value. I decided that one possibility was using amateur radio for some more serious purpose than it's usually used for. Hams are there in an emergency, but much of the rest of the time it's talking about the rig and the weather. And it seemed to me that this incredible worldwide tool could be used for personal growth and social change. So I contacted some of the U.S. ham magazines. One said yes, they'd like me to do a column. And so I started what was a loose network of hams called New Directions Radio, where I advocated ham radio as a tool for people who were moving from the cities back to the land as a way of keeping up their intellectual life. And the editor of that magazine asked me if I'd like to do a regular column. At the same time, there was the great problem at Wounded Knee and the Watergate thing, and we started to ask ourselves, is this the country we really want to be spending the rest of our life in? I mean, we'd seen some of the rest of the world. We realized there were other possibilities. And it was Canada that felt right to us, felt best, that a country where the people cared for each other in a deeper way. And so we applied to become immigrants to Canada.
Early in 1975, they piled their earthly goods into a used van, drove up Route 95, and crossed the U.S.-Canada border. They settled in Halifax. Here, Kopp decided to abandon his engineering career. Two things influenced his decision.
One was this brain hemisphere theory, which was became popular in the 1970s. This idea that one of our brain hemispheres deals with intellectual matters, rational thought, and the other hemisphere dealt
with pattern, and at that time we thought artistic pursuits and nurturance, the sort of non-verbal, non-rational, non-intellectual aspects of life. So in my own analysis of what I was reading, it seemed that the whole human being was a person who had developed both hemispheres of their brain. I had a well-developed left hemisphere. This rational thought hemisphere was working fine, thank you very much. But I felt that this other side of myself was not developed. And I thought that just working with people in a totally non-intellectual environment would be good, would help me grow. At the same time, feminism was telling us men, hey, develop the nurturing side of yourself. Look, you're only half a human being. Go develop that side. So as a result of both of these influences, I decided to get a job as a nursing orderly.
They moved to Charlottetown in October 1975, where Madeline worked as an RN and Kopp as a nursing orderly at the Prince Edward Island Hospital. He gave bedridden men sponge baths, emptied bedpans, and bathed corpses before taking them to the morgue. He came to a new understanding of death and the fragility of life.
Like most people in our culture, I'd been totally separated from, you know, death and dying, except for, you know, rare occasions where you see a cosmetically veneered corpse in a funeral parlor. On two occasions, I was bathing patients in their bed at the very moment that they died. In both cases, that moment happened as I was turning the patient from one side to the other. And it brought home to me the fragility of life, that here this person was just on the edge between life and death, and the small stress of just turning from one side to another was just too much at the end. And at any rate, it was just a very powerful experience.
For the remainder of the 1970s, he worked as nursing orderly and then as activity director at the Prince Edward Island Home for the Aged. He also began writing the first draft of the book that was to be Toward Wisdom, published 16 years later. He continued writing his New Directions radio column for Mother Earth News, and once again his attention was drawn to the arts. This time it was to music. In 1981, Speed the Plow, a group of local and come-from-away musicians, gave a concert at the University of Prince Edward Island. One of the musicians played the cello. It struck Kopp what a wonderful instrument it was, human-sized and human-voiced. So he bought a cello and took some lessons. He studied for a year until he saw that he didn't have much musical talent. But he had satisfied himself with this exploration, and his lifelong appreciation of music deepened. He had run another life experiment. Kopp's experiences with death led him to a change from awareness of self to an awareness of the larger intelligence of the universe. He began meditation practice. He wove together strands of his knowledge from the scientific and electronic worlds and his growing understanding of philosophical, psychological, and spiritual realms. He began to clarify for himself the medium and message nature of reality.
For a long time, there has been this perennial philosophy idea, this idea of two realities. And it's been called the perennial philosophy because it's popped up at different times and different places independently. We find it in Buddhism, in the Vedanta side of Hinduism, in Christian mysticism. And the sort of rough general feel that these messages from earlier times said was there's sort of two kinds of reality, a transient, temporary, maybe even illusory reality, which is unfortunately the reality that we identify with. And then there is an enduring, more primal reality that is our real home. And I had read about these ideas, and during a retreat in my apartment back in 1980 that went on for about five weeks, it struck me one day that what we were really talking about here is medium and message, or carrier and information. There's an ocean wave analogy that may help make this clear. The ocean is the carrier of the waves. The waves are constantly changing, and the waves are an informational modulation of ocean. Ocean is the deep, lasting reality. The waves are the ephemeral, ever-changing relative reality. And it is this relative reality of information that we live in. This is our total experience. And the Buddhists talk about it being unsatisfactory because it is subject to change. And the informational pattern that is our human body eventually deteriorates and disintegrates, and life in human form ends. The informational pattern goes awry and we get sick. We as human beings see this informational reality as the only reality, when in fact it is this relative informational reality is a product of the more primal reality, the reality of energy awareness, which is at the root of this whole complex, wonderful universe.
In the 1980s, Kopp moved from work with hospital patients and the elderly to become an energy consultant for the government. He was coordinator for a Prince Edward Island energy conservation program. His interests were alternative technologies and renewable resources. By the mid-1980s, he had published 125 articles and papers and was writing full-time. Kopp turned his attention from medium to message. In 1993, Toward Wisdom was published. It is essentially a how-to manual, How to Get Wise. Kopp's aim is to enable readers to help themselves build lives that have wisdom as a goal.
My writing, at least the close to the heart writing, the writing I've wanted to do just because I wanted to do it, has always come out of a feeling that I have something interesting and something important to say. And it was my own exploration of meditation and life that at some point made me realize that the missing ingredient in our individual lives and in our society is this old-fashioned thing called wisdom. If our world is going to continue on in a sustainable way, human beings, we've got to behave differently. We've got to think differently. And wisdom is this sort of catch-all phrase that encompasses a lot of those things that have to be different. And so that is why I wrote Toward Wisdom.
Kopp has changed from being fascinated by process to being engrossed with the importance of content. A pivotal moment took place on a solitary walk one autumn day during a three-month meditation retreat. He experienced a profound identity shift.
Ordinarily, I feel as though I'm on this knife edge between the past and the future. That now seems like a knife edge that I have difficulty remaining in. And all of a sudden, this knife edge opened up, and now was what was. Psychological time stood still. There was just now, and now continued. And as I looked around at the beautiful fall scene, the yellow leaves, the brown leaves, this whole informational picture, the realization came to me, yes, this is my body. This is my informational body, and my deepest, truest self is the energy that underlies this. Our teachers in high school told us energy cannot be created or destroyed. There is this aspect of reality that is enduring, and I am that. And yet I had no feeling of rejection of this informational scene before me. It was as it should be. Everything was as it should be.
Today, Copthorne McDonald thinks about, writes about, and talks about the subject of wisdom. He rises very early, spends some time in meditation, and then he writes. He has just seen the publication of his second book about wisdom, Getting a Life. Always, his challenge is to frame wisdom in words that are easily understood.
First of all, wisdom is a catch-all term for a great many characteristics or qualities or elements. It's a multifaceted thing. And I see three types of characteristics. Wise people have some exceptional attitudes. They have what I would call wise attitudes. They are reality seekers. They want to know the truth. The second category are value-based ways of being. Wise people behave in ways that contribute to the lives of others. They are self-reliant and self-disciplined. There are a whole list of things in that category. The third category are perspectives and interpretive frameworks, which we could call wise ways of seeing. Our sense of vision is incredibly limiting and sometimes distorting. And the unfortunate thing is we have this tremendous confidence in what vision tells us is pretty much the whole story, or enough of the whole story to get us through life. In a hunter-gatherer world, it was. But now we've got 5 billion plus people on Earth, and a lot of us are equipped with powerful technologies, and we're causing impacts which are very, very negative and What we don't see with our eyes is all the interconnectedness of our lives, the biosphere. We've got a whole system here with an intricate network of interconnections, and underlaid by an absolute reality, which is creating this incredible, interesting world of informational patterns, which is the world that we live in now. So, for example, one way of seeing that some of the wisest people have had is to see the interconnections, to understand that all those interconnections are there. We breathe in air, you know. That is our connection with the atmosphere, and it's absolutely essential. You know, we close off the mouth and nose for 20 minutes and we're gone. And yet we think of ourselves as independent beings, and we're absolutely not. We're linked physically into the process.
Copthorne McDonald has been an engineer and a magazine columnist in the alternative press. He's designed and invented elegant electronic systems. He's been an energy consultant. He has a clear understanding of absolute and relative reality. He believes that anyone can build a new interpretive framework for seeing life. He believes that anyone can build a life based on wisdom.
My life as an engineer taught me that science speaks truth. I've been able to do a lot of creative things by understanding scientific law and how those laws were embodied in various little electronic components. I was able to create electronic systems that never existed before, that, you know, functions that had never happened in the history of the universe, as far as I know. And I was able to do this because scientific law reflects the way reality is. So I had, on the one hand, this set of truths that I was totally convinced about. Through my meditative practice, and particularly on going on retreats of, you know, a week or longer, and my mind got profoundly quiet, these gestalt shifts occurred, and I was able to appreciate oneness and interconnections at this other very deep level, and this also screamed truth to me. This just was the way things were. Now, then I face the question of how do you resolve these two things? How, on the one hand, we have science, which talks about phenomenon. On the other hand, you have this experience of oneness. And, you know, how do you bring the two together? And interestingly, there were some things in communications engineering that provided the paradigm, if you will, the sort of overarching way of looking at things that encompassed both of these two realms. And this is the concept of information, which was quantified back in the 1940s and has become a real hard piece of science. And what I realized was, and this is not, I mean, the basic idea is not original with me. The spiritual teachers have been, you know, giving this message for 2,500 years or more. And the term that Aldous Huxley used for it was the perennial philosophy. And the basic idea is that there is an absolute reality that is enduring and which is the source of a relative reality, which is an ephemeral, transient reality of form. So on one hand we have substance in some enduring sense, and another sense we have this ever-changing reality. So physically speaking, the world is energy patterned or formed or shaped or modulated in space and time informationally. Information is a pattern of differences in some medium, and we can look at the whole physical universe as an informational patterning of energy. Mentally, the substrate of the mind, the absolute reality, is just this awareness. And it is capable of being aware of whatever. And our brain, with all its neuronal firings, modulates the awareness. It creates a variety of mind content, which are just like waves of awareness. Just as the physical world is like waves of energy. What we are doing with our creative capabilities and with our desire-based physical and material consumption is to grossly impact the evolutionary process. Evolution, through its own inherent chance and necessity mechanisms, is very, very, very slow. Human beings, when we can bring the brain and mind to bear on these things, can make things happen incredibly faster. A lot of what we've been doing has been negative, but there's no reason why, if we get in tune with what the universe seems to be trying to do, and we look at the best stuff it's been doing and the highest stuff, that being agents of evolution already, we can't shift our focus and work in harmony with the highest set of possibilities in this universal process.
Tonight on Ideas, Becoming Wise, a profile of Copthorne MacDonald by Deirdre Kessler. Production in Charlottetown was by Barbara Nymark with technician Barry Vesey. Tomorrow night, a program called Common Chords, which looks at the similarities between early Baroque music and modern American jazz. And coming up next, the CBC News, followed by Between the Covers. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht, and I'm Lister Sinclair.